this conversation, you're going to learn a lot more about how the gut microbiome impacts your mental health. Have a listen, because it will tell you so much more about why your fibre is key to your mental health.
And explain what I do for a living. And I'm going to do that using this mad purple beetroot bread here. And I'm going to talk about genetics and how we personalise bread. So I notice when I chat to people that they don't really understand what I do. They go, oh, you're a baker, but you do healthy bread. Actually, it's a level up from there. What I do is I use the same kind of tests that nutritionists use. And I don't diagnose, but what I do is I start off with a questionnaire. And that takes the person who's doing the questionnaire, can take them an hour and a half to fill in, maybe more. Because I go back and I actually look at their history, their family history, what they're doing, how they're doing it, and where they're at. Now, sometimes I don't need to do any tests after that, because, you know, I can look at it and go, ooh, there's some really obvious things that you're doing here that mean that we can do things that are really going to change the way that your gut and your bread works. Now, there's no point to doing testing if someone has got an approach to their food that is so far away from what we do. First changes sometimes are actually quite difficult, because sometimes you're moving so far into eating healthily that actually just that first 2 or 3 months is just actually, come on, let's just reset here. Sometimes it's stress at work, sometimes it's eating a lot of junk food, and we just have to slowly start moving them over. Now, then what happens is, in the old days I used to do a gut test, and what I actually do now is I actually do a nutrigenetics test. And nutrigenetically, on its own, I can't see what I need to know. I need to know the lifestyle first before I can then put that together. Once I get the nutrigenetics testing back, I start to see potential pathways within their genetics that show me some of the things that their body and their framework does. Now, it doesn't negate the gut. The gut is within the framework of you. Your genetics are a framework, so gut health is key. But if I start with the genetics, and you were saying earlier, I don't know if you want to come gather around. You were saying earlier that you can start with testing, but actually, if sometimes you just need, before you get there, actually it's better to do a lifestyle assessment and then a genetics and then gut, which is the way I do a gut test last, not first. Because if I still can't get the person sorted out after lifestyle changes, dietary changes, working around their genetic profile, and then I've still got problems, then I'll start looking into the gut. But if I do it first, it's not the start point. What's your thought?
There's lots of different ways around it. I think that the thing about doing genetic tests is that they never change. You only have to do them once. Yeah. You've got that information. So at whatever point in the process that you want to do that test, and obviously it depends on, you know, somebody's, you know, financial situation as well, because the tests, you know, do come with a bit of a cost. But also, you know, with regards to like, say, for example, stool testing or even blood tests, you know, you can look at somebody's diet and you can look at their health issues and their symptoms potentially and go, yeah, I could probably say that you're definitely deficient in folate. I don't need to test that. Or, you know, you could say, you know, if they have huge immune issues and it's March or April, you can probably almost definitely say you're deficient in vitamin D, so getting outside and getting some sunshine is going to be really helpful. And it's the same with the stool test. You know, if you look at someone's diet and it's very restricted and they've been eliminating one food after another because they think they're reactive to everything,
yeah,
until you start to address that and start to put back in diversity into the diet, you know, if you do that stool test right at the beginning, yes, it's going to show you exactly what you already know, that the diversity in the gut is very low and the richness of the microbiome is very deficient and depleted.
So, and especially, so for example, and I'm sorry, Mike, this is you.
Use me, yeah.
Okay, you've got foot two. And foot two means that your body doesn't excrete sugars into your system around your gut. So this is a really great example of exactly what you're saying. So we know that if you're not getting diversity in your gut, your diversity of your microbiome will be lower because you're not putting sugars out within your gut. So when I see that genetic, if you're not getting diversity in your diet anyway, you can see it from that first questionnaire and you can start bringing diversity in. But once you then have the genetics, you can see that your diversity will be lower because you've got that foot two.
Okay.
So you can look at the diet and say, actually, you're only eating about three different things here. Mm. And that you don't need a gut test for that. But when you go to the next layer, if you see that someone's eating lots of diversity and lots of plant things, actually, you can then go to the next stage. Mm. And that's when you would see. And that's when diversity in your diet starts becoming really important, because your microbes are already in your framework, are slightly on the back foot, because you are a non-secretor. Does that make more sense?
So there's different, with the different gene names and enzymes and pathways, there's one particular pathway which you're talking about, which is the one that means that you have a higher propensity to be able to produce certain fatty acids in the intestine, in the colon, that, you know, provide the mucosal security of that intestine. So, you know, the integrity, it means that the gut function works better. That also then has signalling to your blood sugar regulation, to your immune system, to your brain, your cognitive function. But just because you have that particular variant on that gene, it doesn't mean to say necessarily that, you know, you're screwed.
No, that gene may
it
not
just
also
means it's about basically working with that and having that knowledge and knowing, oh, I have that slight propensity. If I eat this very depleted diet or this supermarket diet that we were talking about earlier, then it's very likely that I'm going to suffer more so than potentially somebody that doesn't have that variant.
Yeah. And we call it expressing genes. So if you're having a great variety, wide, diverse diet, the gene expression actually is triggered by lifestyle and diet. That's where you have to have that combination. So actually when people say, could you just test my genetics and tell me what? It's not possible, is it?
And actually you can look at, so you know, you can look at someone's health at age 5 compared to their age at 30 compared to their age at 50, and so many things change in that lifetime, but the genetics don't. So therefore it is about then looking at that moment in time and looking at that genetic report and helping that person in that moment of time based on their diet, their lifestyle, their stress, their environment.
It's contextual.
Yeah.
Totally.
So you have to look at all of that. So you don't do the assessment, you can't then assess the genetic report.
Yeah, exactly what you just said, exactly what I've been trying to say. And that is why. And then you've got your next level. So here's your next level. So even if I then look at the gut, I know that once I start bringing in the bread, the gut changes. So there's almost no bloody point starting with your gut, because I'm like, wait till you've been eating this for 3 months. If you've still got problems, then I'll start looking at your gut, because it means that here is the problem. But there are so many other things here that why spend all this money on a gut test when I know that we can, that it will almost inevitably, the gut will start sorting itself out, because you're giving it what it needs. So actually the gut test is my last resort. And then if we roll back, so this is a really good example of a bread. It's actually, we should have done this yesterday, so it's actually had a really long ferment, and I'm hoping that it will come together now. It's had 24 hours in the fridge longer than I would expect, but this is genetically, the GSTM will null gene, which is what I've been actually getting my notes out on here. I'm going to read some of this because I don't remember everything. So GSTM1 gene is a glutathione S transferase M1 gene, and it plays a huge role in what we see as phase 2 detoxification. Now look, I know you're going to be like, what on earth is phase 2? We haven't learned a lot about this, but look, phase 3 is getting rid of toxins through your sweat, getting rid of it through your urine, getting rid of it through your breath. I mean, I don't know if you know that, but actually that sometimes can, you can sometimes smell someone detoxifying, and through your poop. So phase 2 is the stage before that. This is really important. So this is a point at which, and I'll lean into Joe here a little bit sometimes, belongs to the GSTM1 enzyme belongs to a family that basically does something called conjugating glutathione. And what that means is it turns the... It turns your ability to take something and turn it into something that is more usable to get rid of it.
Less toxic.
Yeah, lowers toxicity. Yeah. So polyphenols that you get, and this is your polyphenols, you can actually see the anthocyanins in here right now. So quercetin, curcumin from green tea, berries, I mean all of these need to be used. And I guess that for people like myself with this gene, it means that I'm less protected for cancer. Because essentially, I'm not really using my polyphenols very well. Mm. Does that make sense?
So the glutathione pathway also helps supports your, let's say, your estrogen detoxification. So if you're not clearing, metabolizing your estrogen. So with hormones, we create these hormones, and they don't just stay in our body forever. They are constantly being produced and metabolized, broken down. If we don't metabolize, say for example, let's use estrogen as an example, and it's not cleared in the right pathway, then it can cause issues around disease. I don't want to say...
Oh, I'm going to jump in personally and suffer from lipedema. Okay. So here you go. Here's my living example. So people judge success on being a beautiful, skinny model. My success is that I have ankles. People are like, oh, someone criticised me a few weeks ago on social media and told me, you know, how could they possibly take health advice from someone with my size and shape? And I was I was hurt for a second, and I thought, actually, no, I'm not taking this. So I actually put a photograph of my bottom up on social media to just really make the point. I was like, no, stick it. Because actually, genetically, I have 7 detoxification pathway blockages. This is one of them, the GSTM1, I've got 0. And so the fact that I have ankles and I haven't developed stage 2 lipedema in my 50s during menopause is actually success. Mm. I have ankles, an actual real life ankle. Look, actual ankles. So don't think that this isn't a living, breathing, real example of this at work and at play, because this is not theory, this is practice. So I've lived it and breathed it. So this one here is a massive increase in the polyphenols. Joe, for people explaining, how do we use these polyphenols then to help get rid of that estrogen, for example? Toxins aren't necessarily just endotoxins. They're not necessarily just the toxins that you're getting from your... You produce your own that you need to get rid of.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, we're talking about genetics here. So if you know that there is issues around certain pathway clearance, then you can support that pathway better by using antioxidants. So glutathione is a natural antioxidant that the body produces in the body. But we can encourage the production of that, also counter the, you know, if say that pathway is not functioning as optimally, then you might have pro-oxidants or inflammation, or you might just need a much higher level of antioxidants to quench the consequence of not having that pathway working optimally.
Yep, that's brilliant. That is exactly why I created this. Okay. So I've massively increased the polyphenols in here, which is why it's bright pink. And then what I've done, because I don't break them down, or anyone, and it's 50% of the population who has this gene, not just a random, this isn't like special Vanessa gene. This is special because it's 50% of the population. And so, you know, this is about protecting against cancer. And so this one here, I've massively increased this polyphenol with beetroot juice.
Can you tell me what that is?
Beetroot.
No, but the...
Oh, this is proven bread.
Right.
Exactly our proven bread.
Plus beetroot.
Plus beetroot, and I put a little bit of psyllium husk in this one. This is exactly our bread, just done personalised. So this has got the extra level up. So I use the Barn Protocol as a framework. Now what this one has got is I've got an HFE gene, which means that that's completely wrong. That is the iron one, and I'll come back to that one. I don't want to talk about that one. This is a problem that I have that...
But it's to do with the running of that pathway.
Yeah.
So not everyone has the genes picked up necessarily in the genetic test, actually, with that particular gene variant. But it's about whether that gene is working fast or slow. So if it's running slower, it just means that, you know, it's not running as optimally as it could do. So by knowing that vary, because it is running slower, you can put in nutrition and food to help it bring it back to somebody else who's that pathway is working more optimally. Does that make sense?
So you can increase the nutrition.
Yeah.
So that's what I've done
or
here.
Or counter the oxidation or the problems of having that gene variant.
So there you go. I've massively increased the polyphenols, but here's where the fermentation actually lifts us into a new level. Because I don't have the enzymes to break down those polyphenols, I've borrowed the enzymes from the flour in here. So by borrowing the enzymes from the flour and borrowing the breakdown, in many instances, the polyphenols, like fluoric acid, for example, which is very well documented by Gobetti, Ganser, and lots of other studies, we are actually bypassing my enzymic block genetically. So the polyphenols are now bioavailable because they've been munched on and broken down. So we've gone all the way around my block, making these polyphenols more bioavailable. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, genetically, what I was trying to get to earlier, I was thinking about something else, was that I have a problem as well, because beetroot juice is fabulous, and it's got that nitric oxide in, which we'll chat about in a second, which is absolutely amazing. But what really, really, really makes a difference with this, and this is the bit that I found really, really interesting, was the oxalates in here will give me kidney stones. And I, again, genetically predisposition for kidney stones, I can tell you that it was right. I have been taken to hospital with kidney stones, and I did think I was dying. And actually, what we need to do is bring ourselves back to an evolutionary bread. I'm not sure that this isn't what we would have done. And I'm thinking about what a Neolithic man would have done. And so I don't want kidney stones, but if I fill my bread with extra levels of calcium, that will bind to the oxalates in the beetroot. Now, I love beetroot, but I don't want kidney stones. So what I've done is something a bit strange. I've gone out to my hens, I've got the eggs, I've put the eggs in the oven so that they have baked very slowly, and then I put them through the mill. And so in here, to grab hold of the oxalates for my genetics, so this is me giving you a living working example of a personalised bread, I've put in about a teaspoon of eggshell into here, and that is enough to bind the oxalates so I can eat this, so genetically it's bound with those oxalates and I will not
touch wood.
So it's not the eggs you bake, it's the eggshells.
Eggshells.
Yeah.
So I put ground up eggshells in here, and that's where I was talking, thinking about Mike and evolution. And what you will understand is, Mike, that, I mean, is this exactly what we would, you know, I mean, does this sit with you? I mean, what do you reckon?
Yeah, obviously Neolithic man would have had genetic tests and stuff to be done that, so it would have been instinctual.
Do you think he would have thrown the eggshells away? Would he have gone crunk, chuck, or would he have actually gone, actually, do you know what, this is, I'll eat these? Because I watch people, like, for example, when I've had students here from China, they've crunched their way through every single part of the chicken bone, including the bone itself.
Yeah.
There was no wastage.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's really difficult to kind of project yourself into that position because, we're so used to not eating eggshells. But you're right. With smaller bones like pilchards and smaller fowl and stuff like that, you would eat the bones and the cartilage. So it wouldn't be beyond the realms that they would have eaten eggshells, and it's a natural thing when you're more connected to your environment and yet you're not, again, all fogged up by modern workings. The animals instinctively know what foods they need, that they haven't read a book, they haven't done a doctorate in anything, but they know, if they need to eat more calcium, they'll eat grit, chickens and stuff will eat grit. And, chickens aren't known for their intelligence,
but they
like chickens. So I think, and that brings us back more to that evolutionary thing where we're more connected to our landscapes and in touch with the workings of our own body and how it fits in with the landscape. So that, I think it would have been an instinctual thing for humans to just to know what they're short on and what they need and to eat that. Yeah.
No, that's cool. I mean, I this is sort of thinking at a very deep level, and I love your sort of, because you've sort of been in that, in your kind of environment. I think it's amazing. Right, so that's been rolled out. I've taken my time rolling it. It's nice and slow, nice and easy. You're going to do these after me. So if you want to follow me over here, I'm going to put this on up. So we wouldn't have cooked these in an evolutionary sense in a normal oven.
Okay.
I think I'm pretty done, actually, to me. I'll leave that open for a minute. So this is hot on here. There's a little bit of oil on here. And the first time with flatbreads, a little bit like pancakes, you have to sacrifice the first one to the pizza, to the flatbread god or to the pancake god. I don't know if you know this. You know this, don't you? Because what you're doing is you're getting that first. So I've got a little bit of oil on my hands. And I'm just going to put this on here now. We would have used rocks in evolutionary terms. I'm going to let that set. And what the psyllium husk in here does is it will allow me to roll the bread into... So it's quite hot. So what I can do is... Because it's very fermented. I'm just going to turn that off, actually. Believe it or not, I'm turning it off. There we go. I'm just going to let that cook really nice and easy. That's going to give me a rollable flatbread, which is exactly what my kids need, because they often want these wraps with that carboxyl methyl cellulose in, and those emulsifiers that make those wraps rollable, we can use psyllium husk for it. And suddenly, I've got this wonderful high polyphenol wrap, which is absolutely perfect to feed the family with. It lasts for a couple of days wrapped up in a wax cloth. So this is this is me showing you how I would personalise the bread for me, and likely my children have got similar genetics to me because they are my children, after all.
Mm.
So it's really interesting when you start to look at that, and you start to look at families. My family, most of my dad's side, passed from cancer. A lot of my mother's side have been suffered with high levels of mental health problems, very severely. And that again comes back down to that MTHFR gene, the methyl tetrahydrofolate gene, which is why it's been so important to me to get that bioavailability of the folate in, because I've had such trauma on my mum's side of the family. It would break your heart if I told you what some of the things were that have happened. But they have included, things that I won't talk about in case my cousins are listening, but let's just say that life was not great and life did end because there was not enough nourishment, and you can see that pathway where they haven't met the needs. And I suppose this is where I feel that social justice takes its role, that if you're not getting the things you need to function properly, then that is a denial of your human rights. It brings me back round to it being an activism. So, and this is now, it's a really slow, nice, slow, easy way of making this wrap. So I'm going to get each of you to do this. But what I want you to see is that it's very hot. So obviously if you're doing it, you can wait a minute before you try and roll it. But you can see the flexibility in this, in that it can be rolled, and that then becomes a wrap, and you start stuffing it with all the good things. Any thoughts on this?
Amazing. Mm. It looks incredible. Mm. Do you want a wrap for that?
I'm just gonna. I'll let this sit for just a minute.
So the psyllium husk will also help with. So obviously another added level of fibre.
Yeah.
So it will also very support. You know, that whole detoxification pathway as well.
So in that whole piece that you made, what sort of amount would you be using in order to give it that lattice amount?
2 spoons.
I'll put it in the recipe, because whenever I share a recipe, this is one of the ones that's a recipe. But I tend to think of it as being about 10% of the weight of the flour.
Some rough flour.
So good.
But its taste is interesting, isn't it?
You've got the tiny crunch of the eggshell.
Yeah, it's that hummus we made yesterday. Very interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about them all. It doesn't taste a beetroot, does it?
How did you crush the eggshells?
I mean, eggshells are really easy. So first of all, you need to make sure they're sterile, because obviously, you know, they've come out of the chicken.
And that's for baking.
Yeah, very, very, very low bake, around about 40-50 degrees in the oven, dries them out. And then I leave them for a week or two, crush them up, and for me, I put them through the mill. But actually, you could just do them in pestle and mortar. You don't want eggshells that are crunchy, because it's not. I mean, respectfully.
I put mine through a little coffee grinder, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like a couple of seconds and it's a powder. So I use tooth and eggshell toothpaste.
Oh, do you?
Mm.
For what?
The toothpaste?
For what?
No, just that. Sometimes, if I'm making it for someone else, I'll put mint or basil in it, so it doesn't taste of eggshell.
Say that again. What do you do? It's
fascinating.
But I use eggshell instead of toothpaste. Have done
for
4 or 5 years.
Just
because,
like,
again,
dentist
toothpaste. I haven't been to the dentist for years now, and I haven't had a problem, touch wood, since. I'm sure, you know, correlations and causation, etc., etc. But again, that's what we would have done with our teeth. We'd use that natural abrasive to get bits out, if and when we cleaned it. Mm. You definitely wouldn't have put all the any chemicals or sugar that's in toothpaste. You're killing all that bacteria. Mm. You know, your body's got hot spots of bacteria all over the place. It's not just your gut.
No, the mouth is.
So every time you use toothpaste, same as you use shampoo.
It's like the dangers of all those mouthwashes that just kind of kill everything.
It wipes the whole thing out. Like, so your mouth's got to start again. Mm. And you're putting all that extra stress in your body, trying to, oh God, you've got no protection in your mouth.
Really,
it's just recreated. Mm. I haven't used shampoo for 45 years, have I?
Really?
Just walked. I must have saved like £20 in my shampoo bills. Yeah, but I just use water. But and again, it takes a few weeks for your natural oils and stuff to come back in. But it works.
There's a reason why beauty businesses. Look at those seeds.
There you go, chaps.
And then you would put. Honey on top of that.
Yes, I mean, okay, so I'm just going to show off now. Which honey pot would you like me to use? Let's just go with the smallest.
Oh, wow, look at that.
Oh, they're for the bees and the set, yeah.
Wow.
So I have I have one beehive this year, so I really should have more, but it's been a difficult year to get everything done.
It's a thing of such beauty, isn't it?
Isn't it just?
Oh. And that's all from your bees?
Yes, and also I have another local beekeeper as well who I visit sometimes because I run out on my own. And it sounds awful, but you know, I haven't got enough time in the day to do everything. So I do keep my, I do a very hands-off approach with my bees. I have just done something a bit crazy with them. I put some upside-down jam jars in and given them those, hoping they'll build a comb inside the jam jar. I'm really excited about it. I don't know if you've seen it before. So I'm hoping that I'll have some...
Do your work for you.
But yeah, so I don't even have to jar it anymore. So just take the comb and honey out as a jar. We'll see if it works.
I love the way Vanessa says, put a bit of honey on your
bed. Oh, I know. But this is just it. So look, you know, you've now got...
Do you own a teaspoon? Or is it just... It's just... It would be too mean, wouldn't it?
Listen, you don't get to be this voluptuous unless you have that kind of feel to you. Voluptuous is actually what we're looking at.
That's going to taste...
But that... Listen, it's... But there's a reason for this. You've got... this incredible bread, but also you're sealing in the moisture. You're adding in a layer of sweetness. It's only on the outside. Actually, if you look proportionally per slice, it's a tiny amount. And so one of the things that happens when you have children, you have people, they actually perceive the sweetness. It's not in the bread. It's actually a perception of sweetness. It gives an extra couple of days shelf life. It's also a live probiotic. Now, if you put it in too early, it's obviously kills anything live, but this is a raw honey. I mean, the colour of this honey is absolutely extraordinary.
Amazing.
You can also spray it, and I'll often spray it with vinegar. That's another thing I'll do. So if somebody is diabetic, I will take out a honey spray. Sometimes I'll finish it if I want to lift, say, for example, again, this is, we're talking about personalised bread. So when I've had someone, who, for example, who's got cancer and they're having chemotherapy treatment and their taste bud change, because we know, I'll sometimes do a miso or soy and honey glaze. I don't want sugar, I want the tiniest little bit, but I'll do miso or soy sauce with a little bit of toasted sesame seed oil, and I'll spray that over, because that miso again elevates the flavour, and the taste buds, is, you know, it tastes better. And you get more polyphenols if you use something like a blackcurrant vinegar. I mean, this is again levelling up to those personalised breads. Again, when I have lifestyle or someone's in a situation and I need to help, this is exactly where we're at. What do you think?
Oh, mind blown. Also realising that the honey that you've used on the top, although we initially look at you taking that spoonful and going, oh, that's a load of honey, actually, if you'd slice that into individual slices and used the honey on it would have... You'd have need more and more and more, whereas this is going to give you the sweetness without all of the additional...
Yes. I mean, you don't have to put honey on it. I just do. Mm. This is the way I finish my breads. Yeah. Some people don't want to, but some people who are vegan don't want to. I mean, it's personal choice. But like I said, it doesn't have to be honey. It could be a blackcurrant vinegar. It could be an apple cider vinegar with a little honey. I mean, just open your minds to finishing the bread. But what I really like is, I play around a lot with live probiotics. And what I often do, and this is, again, you want to blow your brains out. You get the psychobiotics. And sometimes I'll put them in a yogurt drink, or I'll put them with the yogurts that go with this, or the cultured butter, and then I start using the psychobiotics in combination with that. And that's Joe. I mean, that you've seen me do that many times. Mm-hmm. So clinically, if someone has got depression or issues with their gut, I can actually target with the John Cryan's work. It's brilliant, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, combine it in a cultured butter, for example.
Yeah.
And, again, it, you know, increases that bioavailability.
Yeah. And also, the live probiotics will help increase the integrity of the gut wall. So what I've done is turned it out just as a check that it's done. And now what I'll do is, I'll just show you. I mean, I actually don't turn it out usually because it gets my table messy and I'm not that messy. So I'll just put them on here like so. And again, depending on what's going on, sometimes I might put a little butter on it to finish it on top, but it's really got butter around the edge. Okay, so I don't put seeds back in there because if I have people with allergies, so I go separately in there. But if you want to put a little honey on each one and then use that to smear it over, carry on.
let me know what you think.
Go on.
Shall I start to roll out some of these?
Oh yes, please, chaps. You have to, a little bit of oil on your hands, squash them together and then come and do them for lunch.